Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 3rd, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing capital punishment after the 2016 elections. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Bill Otis, a former federal prosecutor and now an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, and also Professor Carol Steiker, who is the Henry J. Friendly Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. I will turn it over to Professor Otis to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion, we will go to audience question and answer, so please do be thinking of questions. Thank you both for speaking with us. Bill, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, Nate, and thanks to the Federal Society for putting on this event. The death penalty was not one of the big topics on the surface of our most recent election. It was a bit underneath the surface, because the two major candidates had different slants on the death penalty, and because other things happening in the crime news and in the culture also had the issue below the surface. I also want to thank Professor Steiker, who is one of the leading scholars and abolitionists, for participating on this call. Her time is scarce, and we're fortunate to have someone of that intellect in on the call. I'm tempted to say that the recent election was the event when the opposition to the death penalty shipwrecked, to summarize it in one word, but I think it's more accurate to say it's merely when the shipwreck became visible. Opposition to capital punishment, in my view, had been in trouble for some time, first because it had already picked the low-hanging fruit in the more liberal states, and second because outside events have made abolition under all circumstances seemingly an unpalatable position. On the election front, probably the first thing to note is that both major party candidates explicitly favored the death penalty, Secretary Clinton with reservations and Donald Trump with enthusiasm. Only minor party candidates opposed it, and they wound up with a negligible share of the vote, even while running against the two most unpopular major party candidates in the history of polling. It's also noteworthy that both parties' Supreme Court selections were and are very likely to support the court's most recent holding in Glossop versus Gross that the death penalty is constitutional. Judge Merrick Garland, as Deputy Attorney General, oversaw Timothy McVeigh's capital prosecution, and Judge Gorsuch has given no indication in the 10 years he's been on the bench that he finds any problem with capital punishment, either in constitutional or policy terms. It may be particularly relevant to today's discussion of the election that in a National Review article Judge Gorsuch wrote in 2005, a couple of years before he came a judge, he said this: "American liberals have become addicted to the courtroom, relying on judges and lawyers rather than elected leaders and the ballot box as the primary means of affecting their social agenda on everything from gay marriage to assisted suicide to the use of vouchers for private school education. This overweening addiction to the courtroom as the place to debate social policy is bad for the country and bad for the judiciary." Now, as it seems likely that Judge Gorsuch, when he joins the court, the future of the death penalty is likely to be left at the ballot box. If that's true, then the recent election is indeed where the image of the shipwreck for abolitionism is most visible. Abolitionism lost everywhere it could, and it lost by wide margins. Capital punishment was on the ballot in three states. that the results overwhelmingly supported it in Nebraska and Oklahoma is hardly surprising. Those are deep red states. But the result in California was, so it seems to me, something like Armageddon for abolitionists. While Golden State voters were giving Secretary Clinton a majority of 4.3 million votes and easily adopting a number of criminal justice reform provisions, they defeated an abolition measure by 850,000 votes. This margin was 75% higher than the margin an abolition referendum had lost by 4 years earlier. At the same time, California voters narrowly approved a measure to speed up executions. When abolitionism is losing in the more liberal candidate's strongest state and losing by a margin substantially greater than the one it lost by 4 years before, it's hard to see the 2016 election as anything but the end of the road for abolitionism or something very much like it. I started out by saying I thought this had come about in part because of outside forces, and I want to close by pointing to three of them. The first was the same reaction so many pundits missed in understanding and underestimating Donald Trump, a resentment among ordinary people with the scorn and condescension of those who run the culture. For years, the predominant theme in academia and entertainment has been that support for the death penalty is at best a retrograde position and at worst maybe a barbaric one. But I suspect the American people who have supported the death penalty by 60% or more, according to Gallup, for more than 40 years, are tired of being told they're uncivilized, something that is, among its numerous other defects, false. Second, there have been recent well-publicized episodes that make complete abandonment of the death penalty seem an excessive remedy for its problems. When we see an ISIS terrorist on tape slicing off the head of a helpless hostage, a college student at the Boston Marathon dropping a pressure cooker bomb to obliterate an 8-year-old boy, and Dylann Roof gunning down 9 worshipers in a church for no reason other than racial hate, the idea that we should never impose the death penalty simply becomes implausible to most people. Finally, among the three, in the 2 years preceding the election, the country saw something it had not seen in decades, a sharp increase in the murder rate. It's often pointed out that support for capital punishment has fallen significantly from the early 90s, and this is true. What is pointed out less frequently is that the murder rate also fell significantly during those same two decades. Where the problem is severe, people will support a more severe remedy. The death penalty is a severe remedy, and no normal person takes any pleasure in its imposition. For roughly the last 20 years, support for it fell, yes, along with the perceived need for it. But if the murder rate continues to increase, as it is doing now, and to a shocking degree in cities like Chicago, St. Louis, and Baltimore, the pro-death penalty trend that showed itself in California 3 months ago will, in my view, very likely go nationwide. Now I'll turn it over to Carol.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Bill, and thank you to the Federalist Society for bringing us together to discuss this topic. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak about it. Bill, that was a very thoughtful presentation, but of course, as you might imagine, one that I disagree with, particularly the word shipwrecked. I don't see the decline of the death penalty that has been happening for the last several decades as anything like in a shipwrecked state. So just consider the numbers of the year that just concluded, the 2016 year that brought us the election. Both executions and death sentences reached historic lows. So the highs of the modern death penalty were in the 1990s, when the execution rate reached 98 in the year 1999. Last year, less than two decades later, the execution rate was at 20. So 98 down to 20 executions is an almost 80% decline. But even more stunning is the decline in death sentencing. Death sentences reached their modern era high in 1996 when 317 people were sentenced to death. Last year, there were 30 death sentences, a decline of more than 90%. And the death sentencing rate is actually the key leading indicator of what the future of the death penalty will look like, because executions in the future depend on death sentences today. And with only 30 death sentences in the previous year, as low as we've seen since the modern death penalty has been revived, we're not likely to see many executions in the future. What's more, the raw numbers don't actually reflect how narrowed and weak the modern death penalty is, because most of those executions and death sentences occurred in just a few jurisdictions. So that only of the executions last year, two states were responsible for 80% of the executions. That's Texas and Georgia. And of the death sentences last year, more than half of them were imposed in only three states, Texas, California, and Ohio. And even within those states, the executions and the death sentences were coming from only a few counties. So of the more than 240 counties in the state of Texas, more than 200 of them haven't executed anyone in 40 years. So the numbers and the concentration of those numbers in just a few states and in just a few counties within those states shows a massive decline in the death penalty. And this decline is reflected in any other indicator that you want to look at. So if you look at the state legislative process, in the last decade, six states have legislatively abolished the death penalty. And two Supreme Courts, New York and Delaware, have declined to revive a death penalty. Two legislatures that in New York and Delaware have declined to revive the death penalty when their highest state courts have abolished it. So that brings to eight the number of state legislatures that have either affirmatively withdrawn or failed to revive, when they easily could have done so, the death penalty in their states, bringing to down the number of states that authorize the death penalty from 38 to 31. Yes, Bill is right that the Nebraska referendum brought back the death penalty after the legislature abolished it. But honestly, you've got to consider Nebraska a really stunning plus in the abolitionist movement, even with the referendum. It's the first time that a solidly Republican state legislature abolished the death penalty. What's more, not only did they vote to abolish the death penalty, they did so by a supermajority after the Republican governor vetoed their abolition and sent it back to them. They overrode the governor's veto to keep the death penalty off the books. Now, the referenda that Bill talks about in Nebraska and Oklahoma and California, honestly, I think referenda have got to be the least persuasive indicator of where the death penalty is going. There is not a jurisdiction in the history of the world that has ever abolished the death penalty by referendum. And the reason is that people are voting their essential gut feeling without much thought or information about the particular process that they're dealing with. So that legislatures, in Nebraska, who heard a lot of the nitty-gritty details about how the death penalty process worked in their states, held hearings, heard experts, they were the ones who voted to abolish the death penalty. When you ask people just straight up, and the Gallup polling people have been doing this for 100 years, do you support the death penalty for murder? Usually you get something of a majority of people who will say yes, and that is what the referendum process reveals. But the more information that people have about the costs of the death penalty and the risks of wrongful conviction, and the ways in which the resources, both judicial and just straight up financial, that are used by the death penalty could be used in other ways to promote the goals of capital punishment, public safety, and retribution, people tend to disfavor the death penalty. And And that disfavor is reflected in the votes, the more considered votes of legislative representatives. What's more is even when we're talking about just straight up public opinion, the Gallup polling people who've been asking the same question in the same way for almost 100 years, this year, the "Are you in favor of the death penalty for murder?" question this past year, 2016, got the lowest response, still a slight majority, but the lowest response in the past 40 years. So in any particular way that you look at, including the political process. So, Bill, you talked about the positions of the candidates. For the first time, yet another historic first, the Democratic Party platform took a position against the death penalty. That's the first time this has happened in history, that one of the two major parties took that position against the death penalty. And Bernie Sanders, who was doing very, very well against Hillary Clinton for much longer than people predicted, was also the first one of the first candidates to take a hardline position against the death penalty. What's more, these positions are not restricted to the Democratic Party. Republicans throughout the country have been taking the lead on death penalty abolition. So a Republican state senator in Kansas just introduced a bill a week ago to abolish the death penalty in Kansas, and a bipartisan Democratic and Republican coalition similarly introduced a bill a couple of weeks ago in the state of Washington to abolish the death penalty. We're seeing an increasing strong Republican presence on the death penalty abolition side for reasons that I think Federalist Society members will understand. The death penalty is a big government program. It has a lot of problems, and it costs a lot of money, and there may be other smarter ways to achieve the goals, the purported goals of the death penalty, than through executions. All of this is informative, but it is also connected to the constitutional future of the death penalty. So the Supreme Court in the last 15 years has built a new constitutional doctrine through cases such as Atkins versus Virginia, Roper versus Simmons, Kennedy versus Louisiana, in which its Eighth Amendment analysis looks to actual practices on the ground to decide whether there is an emerging constitutional consensus against a particular practice. And in this way, the court has declared unconstitutional practices that are still rather robust. For example, the court's decision to outlaw execution of juveniles or people with intellectual disability. And this doctrine, which has been elaborated primarily by Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's a key swing justice on this court and will remain so even if Judge Gorsuch is confirmed for the seat that that used to be held by Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy will be the decision maker, I think the key decision maker on this in the near term. And I think that all of the indicators suggest that there's a powerful Eighth Amendment argument to be made to this court. But what's more is even if the court does not in the short term constitutionally abolish the death penalty, I think it's virtually inevitable that the court will do it in the long term, given the trajectory of the American death penalty over the past two decades. So whether it's in the next few years or in another generation on the court, I predict this will happen one way or the other, that we're looking at the death of the American death penalty in the short term or the long term.
Okay, well, those were excellent opening remarks. Bill, would you care to add some additional remarks of your own or questions?
I might. I thought Carol did an excellent job in going through a number of points that we do need to think about. Let me take some of the points that she made in the latter stages of her remarks, pointing out, for example, that Justice Kennedy a number of times in Kennedy versus Louisiana, maybe the most prominent one, but there have been others that Justice Kennedy has shown some skepticism about the death penalty. But it seems to me his most recent vote in an important death penalty case, Glossop versus Gross, is some handwriting on the wall that people opposed to the death penalty can't be happy with. He joined Justice Alito's majority opinion without any concurrence and without saying anything at all. The other interesting thing about the Glossop opinion as respects the possible future of the death penalty was that among the four dissenting justices, only two, Breyer and Ginsburg, suggested, and they suggested pretty strongly, that they would find the death penalty unconstitutional per se. The Clinton-appointed justices, Sotomayor and Kagan, did not say that and did not join the Breyer dissent. They're not joining that dissent. I mean, I thought Kennedy's not writing separately was bad news for the abolitionist movement. One other thing that Carol was saying, a number of states, six states, I think, in the last 10 years, have abolished the death penalty. That's true. None of them have done it by a direct vote of the people. It's all been either state legislatures or the state judicial system. But perhaps even more important than that is those states were states in which the death penalty had de facto disappeared years or decades ago. In other words, the de jure abolition of the death penalty in those states was simply a ratification of the status quo ante. One other thing, although it's true that Gallup support in recent years, the peak for Gallup support, I think, was 80% supported the death penalty in the mid to late 90s, and it has been falling off since then. Over the last several years, the last 6 or 7 years, Gallup finds support for the death penalty at either 60% or the low 60s. That's fairly stable for a 6 or 7 year period. Support for the death penalty at 60 or the low 60s, that is both stable and strong. No president has won that percentage of the vote. It's actually in a democracy that's quite a bit. And I do think Carol and I have different perspectives on the fact that the death penalty, when it is abolished, it's only abolished by institutions that are one level away from the people. I view this in a way different from the way Carol does. It seems to me that whether we're going to have the death penalty is one of the most fundamental moral issues, although there are other issues involved in the death penalty, whether the state ought in any circumstances to have the power intentionally to kill one of its citizens, even for an egregiously terrible thing like child murder or multiple murder. That question is so fundamental and so fundamentally a moral question that it seems to me the proper way to resolve it is precisely through referendum of the people rather than have it removed to institutions that view themselves as more educated or more elite. This is one thing I meant when I said that one of the things that happened in the last election, and this is a commonplace observation by now, is that Trump's victory reflected an increasing discontent and resentment by ordinary people that the world gets run by people like Carol and me, people who went to fancy law schools and teach at fancy law schools, and by people who run the culture in academia generally and in entertainment. And probably the most significant fact about our most recent election is there are actually millions and millions of votes counted, and those were from ordinary citizens. And as both of us have agreed, wherever the election was held, in a very big and liberal state like California or in smaller and conservative states like Oklahoma and Nebraska, the result was pretty much the same, which was an overwhelming rejection of the idea that we can never have the death penalty. And that, I guess, this is the last thing I'll say in this segment. Carol correctly points out that there are problems with the death penalty. It's costly. It goes on for years, which keep victim families involved in litigation for years. No one thinks that's a good thing. The problem is that outright abolition, that to say we can't have the death penalty, no matter how egregious or hair-raising the circumstances, like the Boston Marathon bomber and like Dylann Roof, just seems like an excessive remedy. That the thing to do to resolve the death penalty's problems is to work on those problems and not entirely forbid yourself in advance ever from imposing it, even cases in which the crime is grotesque and the defendant's guilt is admitted by every sane person.
Those are some very compelling points, but I just want to point out one thing. When you call for, you know, direct democracy and having people vote directly rather than through less democratic institutions, let's just remember that this past election, the majority of the popular vote went to the Democratic Party, which was went to the Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, who was, as you say, much more skeptical of the death penalty, said she'd be delighted to breathe a sigh of relief, I believe she said, if the Supreme Court abolished it, and not to Donald Trump, who was elected only through the anti-democratic provisions of the Electoral College. So it seems a little odd to be pointing to the 2016 election results as supporting the point while also claiming that direct democracy is the right way to resolve things, because we need to remember that the people...
The difference is that who we select as president involves very, very many factors, questions of temperament, leadership, experience, where they stand, or what we should do about Social Security, about Iran, about Russia, a whole panoply of important issues. Where one stands on the death penalty, in my experience debating it over the years, tends to boil down pretty quickly to whether you think there are crimes sufficiently grotesque that even though there are risks in some other cases that you might execute an innocent man and that you're going to spend millions of dollars even executing a guilty one, that nonetheless there are some cases so clear, and I've named a couple of them, the McVeigh case, the Boston Marathon bomber, Dylann Roof, they're so clear and so horrible that it seems that just a jail sentence, no matter what its length, just doesn't fit the crime. The principal, I guess, idea that most of us grew up with well before we went to law school was that the punishment should fit the crime. And I believe it seems to most people that just a jail sentence, no matter what its length, for someone like Dylann Roof or the Boston Marathon bomber, doesn't fit. And therefore, that complete abolition is a one-size-fits-all remedy that leaves injustice, and it's an injustice that we can avoid by continuing to have the death penalty available to juries in extreme cases.
Yeah, I don't think that actually captures the modern death penalty debate. I don't think any of the eight states that either legislatively abolish the death penalty or refuse to bring it back when their state high courts abolish the death penalty. You know, I'm an expert on this. I read all these debates. I sometimes have testified in these state legislatures. This is not what they're interested in. They're really talking about the death penalty as an institution, as a legal system, not as a moral right or wrong of the state. Honestly, those were the debates of the 1960s about the death penalty. If you're talking about that era, I think that what you're describing is sort of the ultimate morality of the state taking life and whether it's justified in extreme cases was kind of the shape of the debate. But from 1972, when the Supreme Court brought the death penalty back, when the Supreme Court temporarily abolished the death penalty in 1972 in Furman versus Georgia, and then brought it back in 1976, and has continually every year continue to tinker with its regulations about the death penalty. The question is, has the Supreme Court addressed successfully the many problems that it identified with the system of capital punishment in 1972? And after 40 years, I think many states have just concluded that it's proven a job beyond the courts, and in fact, one that's impossible to do, to prevent error, to use that money wisely. For example, in California, although the money is skipped, and this is why I think the referenda is not that significant, because I think it's the people who apply the death penalty who realize the exorbitant cost of the death penalty in a state like California, where the delays which the people are responding to by trying to speed things up, I don't think likely very successfully through the referenda process, have yielded a death penalty system where each execution in California over the past 40 years, if you add up the costs of running California's death penalty system by the 13 executions it's carried out in the last 40 years, you get more than $250 million per execution in California. No sane person could say that is a system that they could endorse. That's a good plan for the state to address the needs of victims, to prevent future crimes, to respond in a sensible and forceful way to the most serious wrongdoing. Think of what you could do for $250 million, other than execute a single person.
I could kind of have three responses to that. One, that you are one of the leading experts on this, and I know something about it anyway, but it's not for us to make judgments about whether it's worth the cost. The people who get to make that judgment are the people who pay the cost, the taxpayers, and I just don't know of any evidence that the taxpayers, certainly this California referendum, strongly suggests that the taxpayers don't think that the death penalty is too expensive to employ. The second answer is that if you have an expensive system, the thing you would do, that it's at least providing what most people view as deserved justice. But it's expensive. The thing you do is not get rid of it. The thing you do is reduce expenses. And the third thing is that we know that expenses and delay can be reduced, certainly beyond what they are in the egregious situation in California, because other states like Virginia don't have anything like the expense or delay that goes on in California. So there are remedies short of outright abolition that continue to allow people to do what they think deep in their hearts, and many of us do, is the only justice that fits the crime when you're blowing up an 8-year-old who didn't do anything that day other than come with his family to watch the Boston Marathon.
California may be an extreme version of this, but every single state that has studied its death penalty system has found that capital trials are vastly more expensive and time-consuming than non-capital first-degree murder cases, even when you count in the cost of lifetime incarceration without the possibility of parole. And the answer isn't something that state legislatures or the people through the referendum process can take care of, because as Justice Breyer pointed out in his dissent in Glossop versus Gross, a lot of these procedures are required by the federal constitution. The only way to change that is through a federal constitutional amendment or a change in the law on the Supreme Court, which the Supreme Court has showed no inclination to do. If anything, the Supreme Court continues to pile this, and this is not a liberal Supreme Court by any means, but this Supreme Court continues to pile new procedural requirements onto the death penalty. In essence, as my brother and I, who've recently written a book about the death penalty, say, the Supreme Court is essentially regulating the death penalty to death by making it impossible for the states to do what Bill would like to see them do, which is have a quick and efficient capital punishment system. That's just not in the cards, not because the people, may not want it, but because they can't do it consistent with the Constitution. And here's the thing, is that Bill may think it's a good idea to just let the people do what they want, to ask them directly what their views are about the death penalty and how to administer it, but that's not the people to whom our system gives the choice that we have a constitutional system, and some questions are given to the courts and to the high court, including whether punishments are cruel and unusual. And our court has said that in determining what punishments are cruel and unusual, it looks to evolving standards of decency, to procedures and practices on the ground. And the court, per Justice Kennedy in many of these cases, has really raised some serious skeptical questions about whether the death penalty in many of its current iterations is constitutional under the Supreme Court's now very well-developed Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, which is what leads me to predict that, all right, not in Glossop versus Gross, but in some future Glossop versus Gross type of case, this court may very well lead to...
if that were Kennedy's view, he for sure would have written something separate.
He did, Kennedy versus Louisiana.
In Glossop versus Gross.
Well, I don't know if that's the case. You know,
word for word with what Justice Alito wrote for the majority.
You know, also, I mean, he wrote in the... what's the, I'm blanking on the name of the case, where he questioned solitary confinement and, you know, cited Dostoevsky about how we best judge a society by how it treats its prisoners. I think Justice Kennedy has indicated in any number of ways that he has some serious concerns about human dignity.
The death penalty represents the state's most serious and...
Ayala, that's the name of the case.
Obviously, on an individual human life. And conservatives like me who are suspicious of the power of the state want to be real sure and very circumspect in thinking about that. But to be sure and circumspect does not ordain, you know, it ordains great care, but it does not ordain paralysis. And the gross extent of delay and expense that goes on in California, I do not believe is a requirement of the federal constitution. I believe it's principally a fact that California, being a very liberal state, overall drags its feet. The principal thing, I was amazed when I found this out, the principal thing going on in California that causes so much delay is that it takes years to get a lawyer appointed to represent the defendant. Years. Now, that can be done away with. I don't believe, I practiced law for a long time, it doesn't take years to get a lawyer appointed to represent a defendant, even in an extremely serious case. And that is one of the things that the voters in California aimed to fix when they adopted Proposition 62, which is going to streamline this anachronistic Rube Goldberg kind of death penalty system that they have now.
Well, we'll see whether it really does, Bill, because the people who get to rule on whether Proposition 66 is constitutional and what exactly it means is the California courts, who are the ones who are responsible for these long delays. So I'm just wondering, you know, what exactly Proposition 66 is going to look like going forward, and how much of the delays that you point out are really going to be changed or are able to be changed. Because really, California may be at the end of a spectrum, but look at all the states, and you will see that capital cases take much longer than ordinary cases. They cost much more than ordinary criminal cases.
Again,
and that a certain amount of this is just not fixable by legislature or by referendum because it's constitutionally required. I think Justice Breyer said a good line. I think it was a line that's also been written by Professor Franklin Zimring, is that you can have a efficient system of capital punishment or you can have one that comports with due process, but you can't have both.
Frank Zimring, of course, is a robust opponent.
He is, but he's also an expert student of it.
And I've lived in Virginia for a long time and done criminal cases in Virginia for a long time where we don't execute innocent people, the length of time between imposition and the carrying out of a death sentence isn't 20 years, it's 7 years. If it can be done in Virginia, it can be done in other states, as in so many instances in human life. Whether you can do something both efficiently and accurately is less a function of this procedure or that procedure, but of the willingness and determination. We all know where there's a will, there's a way. And when you have a system that requires 8 to 9 years to appoint a lawyer where nothing is happening, you're just appointing a lawyer, that's just wasted time. And that can be done away with. And we can move more toward a system like Virginia that is a reliable system, does not execute innocent people, but it's much faster.
Well, I think, you know, when you talk about changing political views, Virginia is a really good example because, you know, for many years it was, you know, a heartland of the death belt and where the death penalty was very efficiently, as you say, although less so than non-capital cases applied. But then for the first time you have state, you know, have governors and senators who've been elected from your state who are outright death penalty opponents for the first time. Tim Kaine, Terry McAuliffe, you have examples of leadership that would have been unthinkable 25 years ago for someone in a southern state to be elected who clearly and unambiguously opposed the death penalty. But that's
well,
what's happening
I agree,
now.
And I give you an example on the other side. It's very much true, as you say, Governor McAuliffe is a Democrat, and as Democrats tend to do, he's much more hesitant. I don't believe he's an outright abolitionist, but he's much more hesitant in going forward with the death penalty.
Tim Kaine is an outright abolitionist, and I thought Terry McAuliffe said he personally was as well. Is that not right?
I defer to you on that. I don't know whether he is an outright abolitionist.
I mean, there's a difference to say that I am going to refuse to follow the laws of the state versus my personal opinion as opposed to the death penalty. But I thought that both of them had taken that position. But this is also happening much, much more in the Republican Party. And in fact, you know, I think this is something that you see that is a precursor of change that's going to happen. I mean, I think you saw this with gay rights in the United States. It was the log cabin Republicans who were kind of the first shot across the bow. And then you had Justice Kennedy declare, you know, marriage equality across the United States. I think that the future is predicted when there becomes bipartisan support, or in this case, opposition to a practice. And when you look at the polling, you also see a generational divide, particularly interesting among Christian evangelicals. Younger Christian evangelicals are much more opposed to the death penalty than their parents and grandparents. And I think that again, like the falling death sentencing rate today, is a leading indicator of where we're going in the future. Just like with gay marriage, I mean, the generational divide is not quite as stark as it was
with
marriage equality, but there is a generational divide here. And I think that's the, you know, one of the best ways to think about what's likely to happen in
the
future.
Yeah, well, one thing I can tell you, unfortunately, from personal experience, young people attend one thing, but then something odd happens. So they get old, and they tend to think differently when they're old. I want to bring up here the Nebraska experience, which I think is directly relevant to what you've been saying about Republican and evangelical support for the death penalty. It was precisely the evangelicals and, to an extent, libertarians who just distrust the reliability of any government system who were behind the state legislature's repeal of the death penalty. And as you correctly pointed out earlier in our call, they had a supermajority. They were able to override Governor Ricketts' veto. But then something funny happened on the way to actually getting the death penalty in Nebraska abolished, which it did go to a referendum. And again, when the people had a chance, by a vote of 61-39, they reputed all of these evangelicals and libertarians, and they said, "We ordinary voters think what you're doing is all wrong. We want the death penalty available to our juries in extreme cases."
And, well, that's after the governor poured hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own money into the referendum process in order to affect the vote. I mean, just like, you know, you keep talking about this as ordinary people saying what they think, but we all know that money plays an incredibly important role in elections. It played an incredibly important role in the Trump election, and it played an incredibly important role in this particular referendum process.
And it played a very important role in California, too, where George Soros and a lot of Hollywood money, I believe the figure was that the anti-death penalty forces outspent the pro-death penalty forces by 20 to 1 and still lost. I think for – this is one of those things that people take very seriously because it does get to them at their heart. Money does count in public persuasion, but I don't know how much. As I say, it looks like one way in Nebraska, but it looks a different way where there was a lot of –
Well, Nebraska was a case where the legislature had by a supermajority – gotten rid of the death penalty. That had not happened. California was not there.
Yeah,
I mean, there are parts of California, you know, Orange County ain't all that different from Nebraska politically. California did not have a legislative repeal of the death penalty. Nebraska did. So, you know, it's not surprising when a referendum goes in the same way that legislation goes. It is surprising when a referendum goes in a different way from a supermajority of the state legislature. I think then you're looking at something a little odd there.
It's surprising, and it's a message, and it was a rebuke. That 61-39 is not close. It's a little more than 3-2, and I would be very surprised if the evangelical and libertarian-leaning legislatures were not considerably more modest in the future, having now had this kind of message from the voters.
You know, I think that when you talk about the death penalty, the most abstract way is to ask people. I think you're right, Bill, that when people hear in a referendum get rid of the death penalty or not get rid of the death penalty, they're voting at a moral level. Like, is there a moral problem with the death penalty? And I think most people don't think there is a moral problem with the death penalty, that they don't think the state should not have that right. I think that's correct. But I think when people vote on the American death penalty as a system, on how well it functions, whether it does what it says it's going to do, whether it's the problems in it are fixable, that's when you get a majority of people, even, you know, a super majority of Republican legislatures to say, you know what, we've tried to make this work, but it just doesn't work. I think the current debate is really about the death penalty in practice, not about in some very abstract way whether we should take that power irrevocably away from the state or whether we should abandon a broken system. I think that's where the voting is going on now. And when you look at that, it's when people get closest to how the death penalty is working that they really abandon it. If you look at the very same election, you know, this past 2016 November election, pro-death penalty prosecutors were voted out of office in a lot of the strongest death penalty states, Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, and Florida. Each had elections that ousted prosecutors who championed the death penalty. And I think in those cases, voters who were closest to what was going on, they knew about what was happening in their local counties, and they booted these people out.
Not because they objected to the death penalty in theory,
but because they didn't like what they were seeing in their own backyards.
I think you're on to something quite important in saying that when voters look at this up close in individual instances and not in the abstract, they tend to take a different view. But I have a different twist on that, and I'll give you the best case I ever heard of, which was the Timothy McVeigh case. There was Gallup polling on that, and it was published in USA Today, and the poll was a lesson. Because there was a specific case, people knew a lot about what had gone on, the number of people killed, 168, 19 of whom were toddlers in the daycare center. They knew a lot of the specifics. It wasn't abstract to them. And the polling said that more than half of the people who in the abstract opposed the death penalty on principle, well, in that case, they were for imposing the death penalty on Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah, you know, that's
definitely been my experience.
I think you're absolutely right about this, that there is something that people are moved by individual cases one way or the other, and that they tend to think about the death penalty in that context. But I don't think that's the right way to think about it. The death penalty is not a one-off kind of thing. It is a system that we have to devote huge quantities of resources, judicial and financial, to maintaining. We have to maintain death rows. We have to give individual prosecutors the chance to decide in individual cases what to do and to let jurors decide. And sometimes terrible mistakes get made. And the fact is, you can't just say, I'll just have it when it's Timothy McVeigh and not in these other cases. That's just not an option. We either have it as a system with all of its warts and all, or we don't. And I think that's where the modern debate is about. Does the death penalty as a system? Now, you know, so you and I may have different moral takes on the death penalty. Individual people may have different moral takes on the death penalty. But really the question of public policy today is the American death penalty in this state, in that state, is it a sustainable, sensible, fair and reliable system? And I think more and more people are saying, no, it's not. And it can't be made so because we've been trying to do that for the past 40 or 50 years.
Well, professors, look, again, the polling, that they ask specific questions about that. Is the death penalty imposed in a way that's fair? And that wins. I think the results there are, again, in Gallup, are 55%, yes, it is, and 40%. It's not enough. 40% is a significant minority, but it's still a minority. This is something where you and I actually do have a big conceptual difference. I think, and the way that I conducted my whole career as a federal prosecutor, is you do cases one at a time. Every case is different from every other case. And the strength of the equities in any given case, although it may have facial similarities and share some structural similarities with other cases, each case and each jury views the defendant and views the crime in a different way. I view this as a great strength of the American system, which is why I oppose adopting a one-size-fits-all. No, we're never going to do it, regardless of the circumstances. I think that is an excessive remedy, and it's a remedy that our people and our courts, and then the Supreme Court, has refused to adopt. I guess we then, at this point, we're close to the end of the hour. I wonder, Nate, are there any questions from callers that we might want to
Yes, I was hesitant to interrupt because I was enjoying the discussion so much. Let me let's check in with the audience. Because of schedules, we do have a hard stop at the top of the hour, but let's see if the audience has some questions we can squeeze in. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Looks like people are lining up in the queue. I'll just make a quick announcement. We'll go straight to questions. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for next Tuesday, the 7th at 3 p.m. That call is titled, What Are We Learning About For-Profit Education? And it will feature Lucas Townsend, who is a partner at Gibson and Dunn. Let's go to our first question of the day.
Hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Yes, this is Mitchell Keeter calling from California. I have two questions, but in the interest of time, I understand if you can answer only one. First, one consequence of Brexit is that the United Kingdom will no longer be bound by the European Court of Justice, which has banned not only capital punishment, but also what they call whole life imprisonment, or what we call life without parole. Do you think that the UK's renewed independence on this subject may lead them to at least reinstate whole life imprisonment? The second question is more directed for Professor Steiker, who's expressed concern about both the risk of error and the cost in capital cases. But one reason, at least in California, why the cost is so high is that there's a much more rigorous review process, much more careful scrutiny of death sentences, so that a wrongly convicted person would actually have the error more likely to be discovered if he's sentenced to death than to life without parole, although, of course, he would die in prison of old age, which is pretty much what the capital defendants do also. Is it possible that by abolishing the death penalty and eliminating this more rigorous review process, they would actually make wrongly convicted defendants worse off?
Well, I'm happy to take that that second question. The fact is that the review process, I think many people misunderstand that the review process is not a review of whether the person did it or didn't do it. The review process is purely of legal error, whether there were arguments that were made that shouldn't have been made, whether the jury was instructed correctly, whether the lawyers fell below some incredibly low threshold of competence in the case. But no one in the review process ever, none of the judges after the case is resolved at the trial level, are able to ask whether or not they think the person actually did it. And so I'm not sure that, you know, the risk of – hello?
Yeah, there are sometimes – there are habeas petitions that do slow the process down. I worked at the Supreme Court there, and that does happen where there's like an additional witness. So even if they don't ultimately work, they do slow down the process.
They slow down the process, but the fact is that once someone is executed, if there's later evidence that's brought to bear or some new kind of technology like DNA that might exonerate someone, there's no way to exonerate them. Whereas, you know, if someone is serving whole life, like during the course of their life, that's obviously tends to be longer than if they're executed. But just to point out that the review process is not a review process about innocence. It's about legal error.
And let me chime in there. That's a good point, but I have a different take on it. The review process, as you correctly point out, goes to procedural error. But what are people really interested in reviewing a death penalty sentence? There is, do we have the right guy? And once it is that, and factual guilt is not only not usually the subject of review, it's not even contested at trial. People don't understand this. Factual guilt is the last thing you see contested. It's all mental state defenses. The question whether the guy did it is almost always conclusive, and the answer is yes, he did do it. So these years of further review tend to be about manufactured procedural questions, not going to the single most important point that the public cares about in deciding the morality of the death penalty.
Okay, this is Nate. We are right up at the top of the hour. Do we have time to take one more question, or should we go to concluding remarks? Speakers, do you have...
I can take one more quick question.
All right, let's do that.
As a limited government libertarian, I don't trust the government with the death penalty. In fact, that's the last person I'd want to trust is our government with the death penalty. In theory, all convictions are beyond a reasonable doubt, but... Professor Otis's citation of McVeigh and the referendum that was done on that. McVeigh, coincidentally, happens to be one of three mass murderers who was involved in mind control research. So we don't really know what caused him to commit that murder or if he was indeed sane, like Holmes said.
We do know because he told us in a 60 Minutes interview in which he boasted both about what he did and why he did it. McVeigh told us that he was in a war with the United States government. When asked, well, in conducting this war, aren't you aware, Mr. McVeigh, that you killed 19 toddlers in the daycare center? And his exact answer, which has lived in the lore of death penalty debates ever since, was, well, they were collateral damage.
He was trained by the Army.
Sick. A man like that is full of hate. And it's a classic case of a man as to whom we are certain did it, and he did it out of hate, and he had no caring and no empathy even for children. And if you poll respondents that Gallup did, 80% of them believe that he deserved the death penalty.
Well, I think that the caller's question from a libertarian perspective reflects this change that we have the libertarians and the fiscal conservatives and the evangelicals all groups who were in earlier years either in favor or just quiet about the death penalty now speaking out against it. It reflects, I think, the changing times and a future that I think is coming sooner or later.
Okay. Should I give you 30 seconds apiece just with additional concluding remarks? Or
those were mine. I'm happy to let Bill have the last word.
Okay, thank you. I'll do my 30 seconds. Abolishing the death penalty is certain to result in gross injustice. For example, for the convict who's been convicted of a previous murder, he gets incarcerated, he gets unhappy with his cellmate, and bashes his head into a bloody pulp, killing him too. What's the sentence for that if we have taken the death penalty completely off the table? And what's the sentence for him the next time that he gets upset with a cafeteria worker or an educational counselor and then kills for a third time or a fourth time? The problem with complete abolition of the death penalty is that it's an absolutist, one-size-fits-all solution that overlooks the fact that the great majority of Americans know, which is that, yes, we have to be careful when we deploy the power of the state to this extent, but being careful doesn't mean being paralyzed, and there are some cases, like Dylan Roof, like the Boston Marathon bomber, where the death penalty is the only sentence that fits the crime.
Excellent. Well, thank you both very much. I did want to mention, as we conclude, the title of Professor Steiker's recent book, Courting Death, The Supreme Court and Capital Punishment, which we also link to in our materials for this teleforum. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professor Otis and Professor Steiker for speaking with us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.